You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus from New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this evening. There has been much criticism, I guess forever, but more so today than ever before, on just how authentic, how honest, and how true the media is in conveying what happens not only here in this country but across the globe. And since the outbreak of the pandemic, many people have criticized more so the media for just the way they approach news and delivering information that is vital to, as I said, not only Americans but people from across the globe. And that's why my guest today, Batya Unger-Sagan, and she is the deputy director, the opinion editor of Newsweek, and her new book, Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. And we'll be talking with Batya for the next half hour and getting her sense on where does she feel that does the media do a great job? Does it do a mediocre job? Where can it do a better job? And how does it affect the public? Batya, nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Al. You know, it's really such a pleasure and an honor to be on public radio. I am a lefty, and so I'm coming at this criticism of the media from the left. And so it's really always so refreshing to be able to talk to people who, you know, are speaking to a liberal audience or to people who I see as, you know, coming at things from a very similar point of view. Because obviously conservatives have taken up the mantle of, you know, fake news and criticizing the media. I think that there is really a critique that liberals should be engaged in, that lefties should be engaged in for the media. And that's what my book is about. So all of which is to say, thank you so much for having me.
No, this is great. You know, we pride ourselves on getting opinions from both sides, but today I think your book caught my eye because it's a voice, and I think anybody that has been willing to put their, as they say, their toe in the water and put forth their true opinions and their heartfelt ideals, we like to speak with. But more importantly, let me ask you this. You and I both share a commonality that we both write. So we're journalists, and this is broadcast. So we come under the umbrella of media. Does the public get the truth, or is the public misled by the media today?
So trust in the media is extremely, extremely low right now. It's the lowest it's been in many, many, many decades in America. This is obviously very problematic, right? Especially during a pandemic, when you have the people who are in charge of purveying the information the public needs. When those people are not trusted, you get things like vaccine resistance, right? You know, that's often blamed on misinformation. But I think that institutions like the media losing the respect of the people are also very much at fault there. And they lost the respect of the people. I don't know so much if it's because of a slant. I mean, the argument I'm making in my book is that the problem is not that the media is too liberal on one side and too conservative on the other side, but that both conservative and liberal media have really abandoned the working class to wage culture wars that really hide the class divide in America by acting like the real divisions in America are political or are racial or are about gender or about all of these issues that Americans really aren't divided on anymore. And I think the average American looks at the media and says, this is not about me. Like, I know that my neighbors are less racist than they were 30 years ago. Why am I reading about white supremacy every day in the news? You know, I know that my neighbors, my Republican neighbors, have embraced same-sex marriage. Why am I reading the word homophobia at skyrocketing levels in the media, right? So I think that there is this sense among average Americans that something is off, and especially in terms of the demonization of the other side, that is really not reflecting American society at large, and that has really led to the loss of trust in the media.
So it sounds like you feel very strongly that regardless of whether you're what side of the pendulum you may be, left, right, middle, I should say center, you find people have learned to coexist. People have learned to accept one another, and yet various forms of media are continuing to put a wedge between them. And, you know, I know growing up, because you mentioned it in your book, Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, I mean, every night, people gravitated. Granted, it wasn't, there was no social media, there weren't cell phones, there wasn't the internet. It was probably the only source people had, but these people, these media icons, came through very trustworthy. And I think regardless, even back then, where you stood politically or socially or economically, you put faith in them. But yeah, I think a lot of people would agree with you that there is a mistrust of media on either side. But so let me ask you this. What's the reason? Is it for ratings? Is it to improve the bottom line? I mean, is money at the heart of all this?
So in my book, what I argue is that it's a combination of two factors. It's become very profitable for digital media companies or legacy publications with a digital media arm to lean into the most extreme viewers and readers as opposed to the broadest number of readers, because digital media tracks who's reading what, and what you're trying to get is something called engagement. You're trying to get people to click on things and then to click on ads and then to comment on Facebook. And of course, the most extreme readers are always going to be the most engaged. And so there's been a shift from how we measure success as journalists. So from a business point of view, there's been a lot of sort of leaning into the most extreme readers. From a journalist point of view, I argue in the book that the sort of what we consider to be like the golden era of middle of the road reporting was really, it was more middle of the road from an economic and class point of view than anything else. I mean, it was that Walter Cronkite was speaking to the vast American middle, meaning to working class Americans, to middle class Americans, and to highly educated Americans. And what we've had in the meantime has been a great sorting. You have now a lot of liberals living in coastal cities, Republicans living in urban areas and in the middle of the country, and their values no longer look very similar. And the media is part of the sort of the liberal coastal elites that have gotten quite affluent of late. You know, 100 years ago, journalism was a working class trade. You would have your journalists living next to their neighbor, the cop, and not making that much more money than them. Today, journalists live next door to, you know, corporate lawyers, and they're not making much less money than them. So there's been a status revolution among journalists. And I think that that has been reflected in the stories they care about and the stories that they want to report. And honestly, Al, it's not just journalists. You know, the Democrats more largely and liberal culture more largely is increasingly focused on a highly educated, upwardly mobile, meritocratic liberal elite that has left the working class in the dust and really sneers at their values, sneers at their way of life, sneers at the things that they hold deep. And again, as a liberal, as a lefty, as a person who's essentially a socialist, I find this to be appalling, and I find it really shocking as well. Like, when did we become the side that sneered at people who, you know, had less than us on every measure?
Why is it that, because you've mentioned it a number of times, even growing up, you know, the middle class, the average working man and woman in this country, since I was a kid, you always heard that they were the backbone. They were the majority of the population, at least in this country. And as I said, they were the backbone. Why is it always the middle class that becomes the target? In this case, media. And why do they take a pot shot at them? Is it because that's where the vast amount of Americans, that's the largest part of the population? Or is there something more to all of this?
You know, Al, to me, it seems like it's really the working class that's become the punching bag of the media, not even the middle class so much. And it's such a great question because it's such a horrible thing to see, like the backbone of America. You know, I think that there's really economic reasons for this. The Democrats and the Republicans were sort of very united around free market principles in the last 30 years, which meant really the abandonment of the working class, offshoring of manufacturing jobs, globalization, trade normalization with China. This all hit the working class very, very hard. And especially with the disappearing middle, right? They've been left to sort of absorb the punches And why did the Democrats do that? I think it has to do with who they increasingly see as their base. If your base is working class Americans, you're not going to send their jobs to China, right? If your base is highly educated liberals who live in cities, right, what they want is open borders, right? What they need is people to work in restaurants and in their homes for cheaper wages, right? They don't care about manufacturing jobs. We lost the ability to understand how important that backbone is to American society. And why it happened is I think a lot of it has to do with college. I think that, you know, working class Americans tend to be more conservative for a host of reasons. They just have a more commonsensical view of the world. They tend to be more religious, more socially conservative, no matter who they vote for, right? So working class Black Americans are just as conservative as working class Republicans, right? But they, even though they vote for Democrats, there's just a conservatism to that way of life. And when you go to college, you really lose that. You start to think more like, you know, you're inducted into the critical race theory way of thinking. And I know this because I have a PhD, and so I was there and sort of saw it firsthand. And a lot of those ideas, they've turned liberals contemptuous of the way that the other half live. And that's really why I wrote the book, Al. I really just got sick of seeing anchors on CNN who were millionaires looking down their nose at people without a college degree and calling them racist. Like, yeah. I just felt that there was something immoral about that, especially if you're on the left.
It's interesting that you said that, and you pointed out that you hold a PhD from the University of California in Berkeley. So you've certainly spent plenty of time within the classrooms listening to classes and different philosophies from different professors, depending on what courses you were taking. But more importantly, rubbing shoulder to shoulder with students, boys and men and women attending colleges. And you're right. I think far less people in the 50s and 60s went to college than today. It's almost a mandate. You must. And it does knock. And I have working class people in my neighborhood. I consider myself working class, although I do hold an undergraduate degree. But I hear people say, you know, and that snotty kid next door, he just got into, Boston College, and, you know, he looks down. And I'm thinking, boy, we never, ever looked at an adult or someone older than us in that way. But again, it goes back to what you talked about in your book, is the media trying to put a wedge so that they can win over a certain, especially the young people. If they get them now, they'll have them forever, and they can basically mold and manipulate and move them in whatever direction. Now, that sounds extreme, and I know some people are going to say, you know, Vona, you're going to be crazy, because that sounds something very sinister, but I get that feeling. How about you?
So it's, I'm so glad you brought that up, because my book is sort of, it's sort of between two poles in terms of the explanation for why this happened, okay? So I too have a cynical reading and then a more generous reading. You know, my cynical reading is that liberal elites have used college and, increasingly, elite colleges as a way of being upwardly mobile. You know, the meritocracy that the liberal culture in this nation is sort of addicted to has convinced people who are smart and talented that, you know, you get that college degree, you go to that elite school, you're going to have a really good life. And that is true. Like, if you go to an elite school, you will be in the top 10%. And that's sort of what happened to journalists, right? They went from not having a college degree, right? 1937, less than half of journalists had a college degree. Mm. Now 92% have a college degree, you know, and the New York Times will only take interns from the top 1% of schools, right? So there's been that sort of upward mobility, and with it, over the last 20 years, people with like a really good education have become affluent. They've become part of the elite. And I think that is that's why they're sort of obsessing over political polarization and over a racial moral panic, a moral panic around race, when Americans have never been less racist, because it's so much easier to talk about that than to talk about a class inequality that you are benefiting from, right? So that's the cynical reading. But I want to say, I do think that the individual actors here, more often than not, are acting out of, you know, they really believe that they are on the right side of history. They really believe that people who are pro-life, you know, don't really have the right to vote because they are depriving women of rights, and that the right side of history would be the side that says, you know, being pro-life is essentially, you know, hating women, right? They really believe that that is true. And I know this because, like, I was once woke, right? I went to Berkeley. I got that PhD. I spent a lot of time, like, in that worldview. And I can remember what it feels like. You feel like if you're not talking about racism right now, you are being racist. You are contributing to the problem. You know, you don't realize that, like, the whole discourse around these issues is just one big distraction from the disgusting levels of income inequality in America that liberal elites are now benefiting from, that they're now sort of on the top end of.
Yeah, it has certainly wedged people in different positions, and certainly, I should say, put a wedge between people from socioeconomic backgrounds, and instead of unifying the country. I want to take a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this Sunday evening if you're just joining us. My guest this week is Deputy Editor of Newsweek, Batya Unger-Sagan. We're talking with her this evening about her new book, which she feels very strongly, Bad News. And that's basically what a lot of people feel, is that bad news is poisoning America. Batya, you talked about, you know, this discourse and how, you know, there's today more so than ever before, people walk around with it, but they don't have to say it. They don't have to carry a sign. They don't have to have anything pinned to their lapels that says, well, I'm better than you, or I went here. You can just hear it in their voices. You hear it in their attitudes. And that I find most troublesome. And you know, they may have been a next door neighbor that you grew up with, and you know that they were no better off than you or I. I have nothing against people who better themselves, and I'm sure you don't either. But there seems to be a movement, and I guess the media would have to take responsibility, almost in a, and correct me if I'm wrong, but almost in a subliminal way. You don't necessarily always pick up on it when you listen to a broadcast, whether it's television, radio, the internet, newspapers, magazines. But there's always some subliminal messaging. Or am I being very extreme?
No, I totally agree with you. And the message is, you are less than if you didn't go to this kind of a school. And let me tell you, like, those schools, they're not actually teaching people, like, critical thinking skills, right? They're teaching them all the same thing. It's so funny, Al. I think about this all the time. Like, what is a better way of learning critical thinking, right? How to question your own biases, how to truly evaluate whether something is right and wrong, than having a friend who you disagree with, you know, somebody in your church who disagrees with you. So I remember when I went during the Trump administration, I was doing a lot of reporting from the South. And I went and I reported on this church in North Carolina, where it was two churches that had merged, a white evangelical church and a historically black church. And they had merged together because they wanted to bring the kingdom of heaven on earth. That's how they put it. And these two pastors, right, they knew their communities, right? You know, virtually all of the evangelicals, the white evangelicals, had voted for Trump. And virtually all of the people in the historically black church had voted against him, because that's how, you know, Americans sort of were sorting themselves over that first election in 2016. They didn't care. You know, the black pastor told me, Pastor Derek Hawkins, he's the most amazing person. He said to me, and I'll never forget this, he said, Batya, I think if I allow a president to come between me and a person of another race, that lacks maturity. Now, you will never hear this kind of a view in the media, right? Because the media became committed to this idea that anyone who voted for Trump was racist, right? And here you have these two pastors every day, every Sunday, coming into church together, knowing that the other pastor disagrees on politics. Like, that is what critical thinking looks like. You know somebody you respect and you love and you admire has a different point of view. Like, that's all it is. It's saying, huh, I wonder why they think that and I think this, you know, and being okay with the difference, right? That's what we've lost. So my book opens with this scene from CNN where you have Don Lemon and Kirsten Powers, both of whom make $1 million a year, sitting there on CNN and musing about how every single person who voted for Donald Trump is racist. you know, I didn't vote for Donald Trump. He said a lot of things that really offended me. But the idea that 50% of this nation, that 72 million Americans are racist because they voted for a politician that you don't like, that's not true.
Right.
And the reason people who are millionaires are saying it is because there's something else at stake there, right? They're getting something from saying it, you know? What right does a millionaire have to sit there and judge, you know, the people who overwhelmingly voted for a president, people without a college degree? Like, where do they get off? That's why I wrote the book, because I just felt that, like, it was wrong for the left, it's wrong for liberals to be on the side of sneering at people who don't have these worthless college degrees that don't actually even teach you how to think critically. They just teach you how to think like all the other college-educated people.
Right. And you know, a lot of people would agree with that, I have a college professor in my neighborhood, and if you pose that question, he would become very defensive that, you've got it wrong. We're training young people today to be the next generation to carry this country. There's a lot of debate on that, but that's not the entire focus of your book. But going back to something that you said, and surprisingly, because I didn't realize, I knew that Trump was probably not someone in your favorite person file, but you were willing to at least admit that, you know, many of the people that voted for him were not racist, were not trying to be elitist. Now, switch the dial. Now we have a new administration, a man who has claimed to be, you know, more like the average working man. And just this weekend, and I, as the old adage goes, I'm not going to name names, but there was, and I don't know if there's any truth to this, and you probably heard the same thing, that while COVID was still raging and while the economy is floundering and while we have tremendous differences abroad with other countries, so diplomacy is falling apart. Our president was building a $500,000 security fence around his Delaware beach home. And I heard that over a number of days, and once again, I'm going, here it goes. They had problems with Donald Trump. Now there's going to be issues with Joe Biden. So my question to you is, you're always going to get various opinions, but right now, people seem to want a punching bag, somebody that they can blame, and government seems to be the target. But isn't that legitimate? I mean, don't they set the tone? Don't they set the policy? Don't they vote the laws that affect all our lives? So shouldn't they be held accountable regardless of what their political background is?
You mean politicians?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they set the tone.
So it's a great question. I think you really can't compare the way the media treated Donald Trump with the way they've treated any other president.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I say that not as a person who was a fan of his, although I think he did some really amazing things that no one talks about, like the First Step Act, where he, 5,000 black men walked free out of prison because of Trump. And
right.
A lot of his economic policy was really protectionist in nature and was stuff that Bernie Sanders himself was asking for in 2015. So I really liked a lot of that stuff, but you couldn't read about it in media, right? Because it wasn't him, saying something disgusting about some minority group, right? So it was like, nobody knows about this, that he renegotiated NAFTA, and it's now the most pro-labor trade deal America has ever signed, right? Who knows this about Donald Trump? But anyway, we know, I can tell you quantitatively how the New York Times treated him differently than other presidents, because a sociologist very helpfully created a scanner to count the number of times his name appeared in the New York Times in 2017, and it was 97,000 times. Now, you might think, okay, second year of a new president, that's a normal number of times to mention his name. Well, President Obama, can you guess how many times his name appeared in his second year in office? It was 37,000 times, right?
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, there was something different about Trump, The media really, and they made money off of it, Al. That's the thing, is their readers really responded to this stuff. Like, they really, really clicked on those articles, and a lot of media companies that were in financial trouble before Trump are now doing really, really well. So it's, they made money off of it. So I do think that they treated him very differently. I will say, during the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I thought that, you know, so I watch Fox News and CNN both all day. I have each up on a screen because, you know, as an opinion editor, it's my job to sort of follow how the opinions are developing, right?
Right.
On the different sides. And I can tell you that there was no difference in the coverage of Joe Biden during the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I thought that that was terrible. I mean, they really, both sides went all in after him for doing what I thought was a very courageous thing. And it was actually most distressing to see the people who had trumpeted Trump for saying he was going to withdraw from Afghanistan, right? Who then started attacking Joe Biden for actually having the guts to do it. So I think I do agree with you. There is a sense of like, you know, how can we tear this person down? Although I do think that, yes, politicians do deserve more attention. They do deserve, you know, more of our, you know, critique when they're not doing well. And it's certainly not the media's job to sort of let things slide. But yes, we definitely do seem to be enjoying having a punching bag.
And along the same lines of what you're talking about, and, you know, and we've only got a few moments, but I got to get your sense on this, is the fact that it seems, and this is really what your book is all about, bad news, that not even looking at the facts, the hard facts that are there, right there in front of you in black and white, rather twist this story. Let's find an angle that will appeal, as you said, with the New York Times, you know, that many posts. I mean, putting the president out there almost twice as much as any recent president, and then gaining financially because of that, tells me that, you know, we have a long way to go to rebuilding trust. I'm talking about the American people. In fact, you know, we're a global society today, so people really follow American media probably more closely than any other. So would you agree that trust has basically ended up at the bottom of the barrel?
Yeah, absolutely. Although a point that I make in my book is that, you know, partisan media is not a problem if everyone's represented. So I start the book in the 19th century with the fathers of the populist press, of the penny press, Joseph Pulitzer and Benjamin Day. And these guys really, they looked around at America. All of the newspapers were only for the elites. And they were like, wait a minute, there are so many poor and working class people, and they're literate, and they have nothing to read. And they created newspapers for the poor and for the working class. And they were very partisan on their behalf. They felt that it was important to wage a crusade on behalf of labor. And it was amazing. I mean, I think if we had a really strong working class penny press, it wouldn't bother me that the New York Times and CNN and the Washington Post and NPR, I'm sorry, you know, were all for the liberal elites and that all of the conservative media was for the conservative elites, right? It wouldn't bother me that there was media for the top 10%. The problem is all the media is now for the top 10%.
Right.
And that's why I argue in my book that bad news is undermining democracy, because politicians take their cues from the media. They take their cues about who to care about. And the media is telling them that the only people in this country who matter are in the top 10%, and that is just disastrous for our democracy.
Yeah, I think most people would agree with you that, you know, if you're everyone's entitled to an opinion,
right.
but let's make sure that everyone gets access to an opinion and that it's not slanted one way or the other. And when you have those multiple choices, you can decide for yourself what you feel is you know, more truthful, and you'll follow along that line. Let's only hope, Batya, that you know, the media as a whole, talk about the global media, and specifically here in this country, because we, you know, we are citizens here, and you know, I know you love this country, I love this country, but we want everyone to get a fair shake, and we want everyone to, you know, the news that comes out to be fair, and to be honest as much as possible. That's really what it's all about. Real quickly, if people wanted to post questions to you, just get more information about the research you did for the book Bad News, or just find out more about you personally, how might they do that? Is there a website or an email?
They can email me. I'd love to hear from them. My email is b.ungarsargon@newsweek.com. Please tell me what you think. I would love to hear from you. Tell me if you disagree with me. I'm always down for that. I would love to hear from your listeners. Thank you so much, Al. Wow,
no.
What a pleasure. What a delightful conversation.
But, you know, this was great. And I got to say kudos to you, because so many times a guest, I almost feel somewhat reluctant to, but you went right out there and said, I want to hear from you folks, and that's, you know, an open dialogue. I mean, it's what it's all about. We need to have open and honest dialogue, and that really helps people to feel that they have someone that will listen to them, or someone who they can, you know, they can pick your brain and find out more about why you particularly feel the way that you do. So kudos to you. Again, the book is Bad News, and the author has been my guest this week, Batya Ungar Sagan. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you.